This is The Gay Life on KSAN. Good morning, I'm Randy Alford. Later in the show this morning, we'll be talking to Chuck Hitchcock and David Wilt of the East End Gay Organization of Long Island. But our first guests are David Israels, who covers city politics and the gay beat for the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and Randy Schiltz, who is a freelance television reporter for KTVU Channel 2 and KQED Channel 9. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Our topic, of course, is the recent CBS documentary, Gay Power, Gay Politics, or was it the other way around, Gay Politics, Gay Power? Well, whatever it was, on the role of the gay community in last year's mayoral election in San Francisco. And as gay journalists who have been covering gay stories in city politics, I know we all feel that it has journalistic shortcomings.
I think the phrase that I would use on this would be reckless disregard of the truth. That the entire documentary was distorted. The people who came to do it came with one idea and one idea solely in mind, and everything they put in that documentary was to be crammed into that idea. And that idea was a very dirty-minded, scummy, sleazy view of San Francisco gay life. And I am amazed and sort of saddened that a news organization as respected as CBS fell into that very dirty-minded trap.
Yeah, that's something that we've seen other people cover, the gay community like this. It's kind of a National Enquirer type thing. But what you say is very true, Randy. I feel not only slandered as a member of the gay community, but as a journalist, I feel that works of that nature bring our entire profession into disrepute.
Oh, it's certainly made me reevaluate my professional standing. I don't know how many times when I've been told by heterosexual editors that I could not cover, say, a gay-related story or something. This is not in TV, but for magazines, say, because I'm a gay person. But yet it seems that people like these breeders from New York can come out here and do anything they want to and get away with it. Where's the equality? Where's the can't do something pro-gay, which is that what they assume you're going to do, but you can come out here and be as anti-gay and homophobic as you want, and that's just what they were.
David?
Yeah, I said in a story that I wrote in The Guardian, I thought it was slander by editing machine. And I think that it's clear that as we go through the script and go over the TV program after it's broadcast, that we see that these people just didn't do their basic job. I know that, for instance, the inflammatory scenes with Mel Wald.
Who was the S&M consultant,
who was the S&M
in
consultant.
Quotes.
Alleged, yeah.
And I spoke with Lawrence Wilson, who is a gay attorney for the chief of police, and he had been interviewed by them extensively, and yet and said to me that he would have been the first person that they would have gone to check whether or not Mel Wald had in fact been a consultant for the police department. They never heard from them on Mel Wald, although they certainly did hear from the producers when they wanted to film in his home and to be able to film Dianne Feinstein amid a group of men who were hugging and kissing, and then be able to use those scenes to somehow sensationalize the program.
I think the Mel Wald point is kind of interesting because it has to do with how journalists can pick out their sources and how you can use a source who you might not want to check out very far. In fact, the coroner, Boyd Stevens, told me that he has used Mel Wald as a consultant, but it hasn't been as a paid consultant.
That's right.
He knows that Mel Wald has spoken to the California Homicide Investigators Association, so it makes Wald's claim that he has been a consultant to police departments not quite so outlandish, because he has spoken to groups of investigators, but he says that this is his profession.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the people involved have verified that he was given money for it. Now, being paid for something is a way of being professional, being trained or certified. And Wald is not listed with either the American Academy of Sexologists or the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, which are the way in which you become a professional sex consultant, regardless of what your specialty is.
I remember when Phil Bronstein was doing an S&M documentary for Channel 9, he had heard of Wald and specifically did not include him because people in the S&M community, I guess if that's what you call it, said that he's just a wacko. And I think if you go into any community, if you go to the Latinos, if you go to blacks, you can find an absolutely whacked out person to say anything you want to have said. And that's specifically what they did when they got this Mel Wald guy.
And what I think this indicates, and it's something that perhaps as journalists we're wary of getting into, which is the intention of a journalist when he's doing a story. But in this situation, we have what seems to me such blatant distortion and sensationalism. And that is that I think that certainly George Kreil was
who is the co-producer and the reporter on the show
and the co-writer,
right? Was looking for those odd aspects of the community, and I have some indication of that because we have another reporter on The Guardian who happened upon Kreil the night of the broadcast of the show after the rebuttal program on KPIX, and in speaking with him at the Fairmont, Kreil said to her that he could understand two women together, but simply could not understand two men together. And I think that's an indication of his own inability to come to terms with homosexuals as people. And I think that comes through in the program. And what we see is a man who really is working out his own problems at the cost of the gay community.
It's interesting that he used the word understand as opposed to approve of. I mean, if he said he couldn't understand two men together, that would mean that he did not understand the nature of his story and yet went ahead and published it.
And I don't think there can be any doubt that there was what we would call intent. There was malice in that story. There was an intent to distort, because you don't make that many mistakes by accident. I know that if I were putting together a story for Little Channel 9, I could not get away with a lot of the distortions that they got away with, because my producer would be reading the script and say, "Oh, Randy, prove this or prove that," and you just couldn't get away with it. But yet they got away with it in front of tens of millions of viewers on CBS. It's shocking.
I think we should point out that, for instance, KQED did a piece on S&M, and no one is saying that you shouldn't do a story on S&M. It's out there. KQED piece, which Phil Bronstein did, was solid, it was balanced, it was unsensational, it made an honest attempt to get into the story, and I think by and large succeeded. I have very few quibbles with the way it came out, and what there are would be merely quibbles. I don't think that we can say, as journalists, that George Kreil and Grace Dekaus, the co-producers, should not have covered the issue of public sex in Buena Vista Park. That's one of the things they make a major point of. I don't think any of us will deny that there is a sexual scene happening in the bushes in Buena Vista Park. Whether or not it's going to call that public or private because it's hard to find is something else. But once having decided to cover that, I think that I'm not going to argue with their journalistic judgment that this was a story. I think that having gone and covered it, they did not cover the story. Nowhere did they talk to gay leaders. In the show, nowhere do they talk to gay leaders about sex in Buena Vista Park, and nowhere do they have any gay leader defending public sex. That is, if they want to cover public sex as a story, they should go and cover it. And the reason is they apparently did not want the gay community to know that they had even gone up there. Sex in Buena Vista Park was never an issue in the mayoral campaign, although it was an issue in a series of park department hearings about the redesign of the park. And they knew that there were this series of hearings because one of the women who they interview said that she was shouted down at the hearing. Now, they therefore know that they haven't story, that it's an issue at controversy. They did not go to the opposite side or a putative opposite side, the gay community, to find out whether or not there was going to be a defense of it, nor does he present any material from the public record. Now, going to the opposite side, giving the opposite side and presenting material from the public record as to the outcome of it are like Rule 1 and Rule 2 of journalism. In fact, the woman who claims she was shouted down and that homosexuals got everything they wanted in terms of the redesign of Buena Vista Park, at the time of that interview, the redesign issue was not yet resolved. It remains unresolved to this day. Ironically, both sides are claiming defeat.
I think over and over again, though, you can see this, and it's just how they decide to go about making the point. A good example is Charlie McCabe, okay, the Kreil says at one point, there is a backlash in San Francisco. But he can't get anybody to say there's a backlash except one guy, this burned-out, juiced-up old Charles McKay from the Chronicle, who managed to pull himself out
of the stupor. I disagree with you there, because he says you're the only person I know who's talked about the problem in the backlash, and I think that indicates that Carl didn't do his research, because at the same time, Kevin Starr was writing about it. We find it in Guy Wright's column.
I don't think there is any evidence that there's been a big backlash. There certainly was ample opportunity for a backlash to happen after the riots, during the Briggs campaign, and never really materialized. So what he does was, since he can't get very many people to talk against us, he rather than saying that maybe this makes the point that an awful lot of people aren't against us, instead they make the point that we've got everybody so terrified that they're afraid to even talk about it, to even say anything about us, and as if we're going to throw as if gay people are going to throw a Molotov cocktails through people's windows who don't like the gay community.
Yeah.
And
I think a key mistake that Kreil made was this mixing in of the sexual scene in San Francisco and politics. And he seems to be so confused on that issue that they become inextricably mixed. Another reporter from The Guardian, speaking with Kreil just the other day, had a conversation with him in which he said that speaking about Harvey Milk, and it's interesting that in the program Harvey Milk plays almost no role, and that Kreil dates the beginning of this powerful gay movement in San Francisco after Harvey's death, which I think any reporter who is aware of anything is aware that just is inaccurate. But Kreil told this other Guardian reporter that. He thought that Harvey had contributed very little to the gay movement, that he was just a man who had pushed his gayness too much, and that the one mistake the media had made in San Francisco is that they had played down the suicide of Harvey's lover, Jack Lira, I think it was 6 months or so before Harvey's own assassination. And that somehow this indicated that there was something wrong with their relationship and by some leap of logic that there was something wrong with Harvey Milk as a gay politician, and by another great leap of logic that there is somehow something seamy or wrong with gay political movement in San Francisco. And I think that kind of logic indicates that this man does not know what he's talking about.
They're not only great leaps of logic, but there are some very specific problems of fact there. On the night of Jack's suicide, Channel 7 brought their cameras inside the apartment to show the scene as it was being investigated by the coroner. Now, I don't know what stretch of imagination that is playing down a story.
Yeah. Oh, and it was a banner headline on the Examiner. I mean, it was not played down as a story. But I think, again, the fact that Kreil looks at a suicide and says, aha, I'm doing a story on homosexuals. Let's focus in on the suicide. Let's focus in on the sex. Right. I don't know. It's like they're accusing us of being obsessed with sex, but that documentary certainly indicated to me that it was just that typical heterosexual obsession with sex, that they couldn't get beyond sex in terms of dealing with gay people. And I think they're doing a disservice to their own kind.
Yeah. And I think what this gets into is a more complex problem, which is how do we get coverage of the gay community from a really meaningful point of view with some kind of insights? As Randy has said, I mean, we all know that. Most of the major news organizations that any of us have dealt with have a real reluctance to have gay people, openly gay people, report for them, because there's always the assumption that we are going to report in a biased fashion. And yet the evidence shows over and over and over again that when straight reporters come to San Francisco to do stories on us, they usually come out with stories like this. And so it seems to me that it's time for the managing editors of the newspapers and the news directors of the TV and radio stations to perhaps take a look at who should be doing the reporting on the gay community.
Oh, well, I think then we get back to this just basic old problem that never, of course, got mentioned in the CBS documentary of discrimination. And if you look at CBS, if you look at every commercial television station in San Francisco. They adamantly refuse to hire acknowledged gay people. That's, you know, a matter of de facto discrimination.
And yet Kreil opens his program with a statement that by the end of 1978, gays had achieved full civil rights in San Francisco.
And there's active discrimination, and anybody works – I don't know anybody who works in the news business knows that. And news is certainly not isolated in terms of the corporate spheres.
And certainly as blacks can tell us from the civil rights movement and from the passage of legislation in the 60s, you know, passing a law does not end the discrimination. That's just the first step in fighting that kind of thing. And it's even harder, I think, with gay people in some situations, because it's much harder to prove. It's much more difficult to get people to fight that, because they usually have to make the first step of coming out. We all know of many gay reporters and journalists in town who haven't made the very first step of admitting who they are.
Because they're afraid they're going to get fired.
That's right.
And those are pretty accurate fears in San Francisco, very unfortunate.
And if that's the situation here, can you imagine what it's like in the Midwest or the South?
Or in Modesto.
Okay. This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and I'm Randy Alford, and I'm talking to Randy Schiltz, a freelance television reporter, and David Israels, a reporter for the Bay Guardian and other publications covering gay beat and city politics and stuff. And we're talking about the CBS documentary Gay Power, Gay Politics, which was on several weekends ago. Just playing devil's advocate for a bit, I can see that one of the reasons that an editor might have some qualms about a gay reporter being assigned solely to the gay beat, for instance, let's take the Buena Vista Park story. I think that I might not want to cover that. I might not locate that as a story, because no matter how it gets covered, it's going to create some unfavorable image or publicity problems for the community. However, if I were assigned to do it, I think I could do a much fairer job of it. That is, my news judgment as a gay person, I might have some personal interests that affect my news judgment. That's one of the reasons that journalism is usually conducted in collective organizations, so that individual people's news judgments and biases get leveled out. However, once that is located as a story and I were to go up and do it, I would locate who the partisans are. I would try to understand what the story is that's going on, check out what's in the public record, that is, go ahead and treat it in an appropriately professional manner. And I think that it's unfair to assume that gay journalists will carry their biases to the point of not covering a story fairly. Here we have a case of the only thing that Kreil's advantage as a straight person was in maybe saying, I'm going to go ahead and get that story. It's sensational as all get out. And it is sensational as all get out. And he made it more sensational. But it also is there. But once he went up there, he was just so totally unprofessional in the way he covered that particular story. And that was the most sensational aspect of it. That it is true that the trust is misplaced and the mistrust is misplaced about who can cover what fairly and accurately.
Oh, and I think if anything, openly gay people in the media tend to be – we have to be more fair because it is more out there. I think all of us in our roles as reporters have suffered tremendously at the hands of – in the gay community itself, because when we do a gay story, we do both sides because that's our professional obligation. A lot of gay people would prefer that the gay people in the media didn't do it, but of course that's our job to do that. And And the idea that we can't do that, which is very much in the minds of television news directors and newspaper editors, even right here in San Francisco, it's shocking. First of all, it implies that we're somehow inferior to other people, that we can't have objectivity, and they would never dare tell a black reporter that they couldn't cover a black story.
They did 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago, but they wouldn't dare do it now. They wouldn't dare say that to Velvet Davis. They wouldn't dare say it to a Latino. They wouldn't dare say it to an Asian, but they can say it to us, and it's because we're still viewed as somehow less legitimate and also inferior, just downright inferior.
I think we see that in the fact that they tend to cover only the sensational aspects of the gay community in San Francisco. I think it's amazing that even today, it seems clear to me, it's my news judgment, that one of the biggest, hottest stories, ongoing stories in San Francisco is the gay community in the 1980s here. And yet we get only moderately good coverage, I think, from most of the straight media. But I wanted to go back to a point that Randy was making about the gay community and its unwillingness to at times deal with reporters. And I think that I am most upset at the CBS documentary because it makes my job a lot harder. I've worked very hard to be able to cover the gay community well, and sometimes that's critically. And sometimes sources in the community don't agree with me, but that's the way the game is played. But I think that the CBS people have made my job and all of our jobs harder because quite rightly, Cleve Jones and Jerry Berg and the people who appeared on that program and other gay leaders are going to be very reluctant to deal with the press. And that's a shame because it makes that story a lot harder to cover.
Oh, and if you look at that, we've had two documentaries now, ABC and CBS. And the ABC one portrayed gay men as being pathetic, helpless, suicidal, little twerps, and the CBS portrayed us as being sex obsessed,
whose only political goal is to legalize public sex,
right? Mm-hmm. And absolute sexual freedom, I think, is what Harry Reasoner read from the script that was thrust in front of him. And it's astounding that they can get it, that in 1980 they can get away with telling these lies, and these New Yorkers think they're so sophisticated, and they come in here and to the sticks and the provinces, and they show just the inability to deal with the most simple story of social change that's going on.
Isn't there a real profound way, though, in which the ABC special and the CBS special and other upcoming coverage on it right now is focusing on the Castro community specifically in much the same way that the national press in the fall of 1966 and the spring of 1967 suddenly discovered an ongoing social phenomenon of some 2 or 3 years standing in the Haight-Ashbury, labeled it, publicly identified it, tour buses started going through and the hippies started putting up mirrors mm-hmm. to the tour buses, and there was big coverage articles in the New York Times Magazine when you know a phenomenon is coming to an end when they finally get around to covering it.
They are Newsweek.
Mm-hmm. That what we've done is made a national, not we, but the media in general, has made a national story out of this in ways that are sensational, in ways that may not, both for systematic reasons having to do with day-to-day and week-to-week press coverage as opposed to being able to see a phenomenon in a longer term, mm-hmm. has labeled this. And I think that for a lot of gay men, especially, say, teenage boys from the Midwest or the sticks in Florida or whatever, that they'll see only the desirable things despite the inflammatory way in which it was presented, and that this documentary is probably good for an extra 20 or 30,000
yeah.
immigrants into San Francisco this summer above the usual 50 or 60,000 who may show up every summer, of whom three-quarters will leave at the end of the summer.
And one quarter will stay.
And one quarter will stay. Or those are all estimates, but we know the phenomenon.
Oh, I have no doubt that because of that CBS special, we're going to have 20,000 more gay people here next year.
Will we be able to handle that in terms of social services? Their image of it is not going to be what the – see, most of the people who come out here have an image that comes from their friends. It's relatively accurate. They've heard the good part. They've heard the Oz. They've heard the fantasy. But they also know that their friends are having trouble finding jobs, that their friends get beat up on the streets sometime. And I know, David, that'll bring you back to a story mm-hmm. you want to tell, and we'll get to it. But they're only going to hear, to them, the positive side. Because if you are 17 and sex is all that's on your mind, it's that
you're
time
not,
of life.
You're going to be freaked out.
Kreil's thing probably sounded real good.
Uh-huh.
I think that what's about to happen is that we're hitting the summer of love, as it were, mm-hmm. for the Castro. That under the pressure of people who are coming in with distorted views, under the pressure of outside media scrutiny, under the pressure of all that stuff, increased rents and speculation mm-hmm. that you've written about so well, David, that the gay community may be coming to an end of a ghetto phase. There's no more hippie ghetto. There's no more hippie ghetto.
It will take over the city.
It may take through and disperse.
Will become our ghetto. I think if you look at the city, I think a good quarter of the city now is gay ghetto. And I think that this is just a personal opinion.
I don't think it's gay ghetto.
There's one point we're
disagreeing. I don't say that the gay community is going to come to an end. Yeah. I think that the kind of intense centrality mm-hmm. in the Castro happened mm-hmm. is probably going to disperse. I don't see the end of that dispersal as necessarily negative. It's like mm-hmm. when a flower goes to seed,
yeah.
it's the beginning of the next phase.
I think one difference, though, Randy, especially with that analogy with the hate, is that what we have in the Castro is not only a lot of gay people who exist there or go there or who use it as a national entertainment zone, but let's remember that much of the Castro is physically owned. Those buildings are owned by gay people. Those houses are owned by gay people, and they're not going to go away. It could be that the scene will spread out to other places. It could be that the phenomenon will become so great that it will spread to other areas of the city. But I think that the gay community has set down economic roots in the Castro and is spreading out, and that is going to continue. And that the one point that George Crowell made, and the only one that I agreed with, was that, you know, we have to, all of us, gay people and straight people, have to learn to live with this phenomenon. And that's going to be the real test of San Francisco, I think, in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I think because we are going to have within 20 years, we're going to have a city largely of Asians and gays. I know it shocks some people to hear that, but if anything, what's so interesting about the CBS documentary is for all of its negativity, it's only going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It says that we run the city. Well, not yet, but it certainly will help bring that goal nearer.
It did ignore the other parts of the coalition which are being built on which that power is based, and I think it's Asians, gays, disabled, and senior.
Oh, well,
By 1990 will probably be a ruling coalition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we are the largest voting bloc in the city.
But to suggest that it is just gays, that it is just gay men, and that the purpose of political power is not social justice but public sex
is to distort
the story. Right. We all agree that Crowell has had several good stories, and he botched every single one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think we should also add that part of that coalition, I think, will also be, and this will be the hardest part of the coalition, will be making alliances with the Latino and Black communities. That's going to be the hardest thing to break as far as certain social attitudes. But to go back to the point you made about can the city handle this huge influx of gay people, I think it's true that gay people more and more are coming here not really aware of the difficult job opportunities, the horrible housing situation, and especially the crime problem, which is a special kind of crime directed at gay people simply because people perceive them as gay and attack them because of that.
Do you think the CBS thing might have contributed to some physical attacks?
Well, I think it did. I know of one particular instance that I've confirmed of a gay man who was walking on Haight Street on Sunday night, the night after the documentary was broadcast. I spoke with him yesterday, and he said...
That was right near Buena Vista Park.
Yes, right at the corner of Buena Vista East and Haight Street.
Which is the opposite end of the park from which people allegedly have sex in the bushes.
And he had just dropped a friend off and was walking alone, was heading home. It was 11:30 at night. Four to six young men came running down the steps, shined flashlights in his face, and the only thing he remembers before waking up is one of them saying, "We saw that TV program, and we're going to kill all you faggots." That man was kicked senseless, spent 3 days in the hospital, and had to have his left testicle removed.
And I hope CBS is proud of itself for that.
Yeah, well, I had tried to reach George Crowell today because he's very concerned with the responsibility that the gay community has to take about this sexual problem that he's identified so sensationally. And I'd really like to ask Crowell and hope to reach him to ask him about his response, whether or not he feels any responsibility for that.
And I think we should ask whether KPIX-TV has responsibility. I think the most profound thing that we saw happen is Channel 5 ran a documentary, and they had so many questions about its honesty and veracity that they had to run an hour after that saying, under the title of "Was the Truth Told?" What is KPIX-TV doing running a documentary when they have to spend another hour asking whether the truth is told? If they didn't think it was honest, they should not have put that on the air.
But,
and it's a typical abrogation of responsibility. They wanted good, sensational coverage, and they put it on there, and now there's a man who's going to walk around without his left testicle because of it.
But that's not the way they're going to see it. They're going to see it they're not going to say that they didn't think it was honest. They're going to say, no, they'll say that they recognize significant problem, significant questions about it, and they feel that their program that they held afterward answered it. And probably as far as the Federal Communications Commission is concerned, and probably as far as a majority of the gay community is concerned, the local affiliate, KPIX, has gotten itself off the hook by having provided the response time and having indicated that they are in sympathy with some of the questions we had about it, which is not to say that they believe the thing to be false and untrue.
And I'm not so sure I agree with Randy there. I think that KPIX, given that they were going to broadcast the program, and as a journalist, I don't want to get into the censorship issue and demand that program should not have been shown. I think that at the very least, KPIX did their minimum. I would have preferred that there had been a rebuttal program all across the nation. And I think that the local affiliates in other areas have a responsibility to do some kind of programming that will counterbalance this kind of malicious attack upon the gay community.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and you're listening to David Israels and Randy Schiltz and myself, Randy Alfred, all local gay journalists, talking about the CBS documentary Gay Power, Gay Politics. We've got just a few minutes left. What do you think is going to happen next? I personally have been working on a complaint to the National News Council on the professional standards of the program, which assumes that every story that they chose to cover was a legitimate story, that they can cover whatever they want. But having made the decisions to cover those stories, that they engaged in certain dishonest and unprofessional behavior. What other places is it going to take us? What will it do to the movement nationally? What effect does it have on local politics? And where do we go from here?
Diane is petrified of us, is what I've heard, that that it brought out every dirty sexual thing that sort of has always bothered Diane Mayor Feinstein about the gay community. That's going to be a negative. I think in the long run, as a TV reporter, it's been my experience that TV creates a major impact when you see it, and then it goes away. It creates a perception, and it goes away. There's going to be there'll be a hangover, so to speak, I think, for a period of time. But in the long run, I don't think it's going to be the great Hiroshima of the gay movement. I think the gay movement will keep on going. It will become a self-fulfilling prophecy for San Francisco. We'll be more gay than ever by next year because of it. And I think the major impact will just be to further alienate many gay people from the media, which is a real shame. But you can't blame them when the media lies like it does.
Yeah, I think that what gay activists across the nation have to do is keep up the pressure on CBS. There aren't that many avenues that can be done, but I think the National News Council censure has to be pursued. I know I spoke with a man from the National Gay Task Force this morning. He told me that on Monday there was a demonstration of some 600 gay people outside the Century Plaza Hotel in Los Angeles, where the CBS affiliates were having a meeting that they're going to be demonstrating again tonight when they have their banquet. I think the pressure has to be kept up on CBS so that they learn what it is that the gay community is upset about, and that they can't pull this kind of stunt again. I'm not all that optimistic that they're going to be very responsive. I know that George Kreil and Grace Dekaus, the producers of that show, are now in Miami doing a program on the Cuban refugees, and I can only feel very sorry for those people these kinds of journalists are reporting on them.
Should be well. That's I think we'll survive. Certainly, more serious things have happened.
What about the cumulative effect of the ABC documentary, then the CBS documentary?
Well, people in this
so that other people are now going to keep a closer eye. Doesn't it accelerate the self-fulfilling prophecy nature of it and distort it too?
Well, I think Dick Pavish, who's a gay activist here in the city, made a point when we were talking before the show came on the air, and said, you know, really, we're powerless until we own a TV station. And I think that that may be a little cynical and a little pessimistic, but I think that in a sense that explains the power situation. And the only thing that we can do, I think, is keep pushing. But I think as long as you've got straight journalists coming from New York with absolutely no idea of what they're doing, we're going to keep on getting this kind of reporting. And I feel in a very funny position because I don't want to go out and tell my sources, don't talk to the media, because I know at some point somebody is going to use that advice about me. And yet, as a gay person, I think that I feel very reluctant to have the media come in and cover the San Francisco gay community.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here this morning. I'll remind our listeners, if you want to hear more of Randy Schultz, you can catch him on KTVU Channel 2 or KQED Channel 9, or read him in publications such as Blue Boy, where he has an article this
Thanks
month
a lot.
About, well, there has to be some redeeming social importance in these.
Blue Boy,
there's
a great story on David B. Goodstein in that.
Right, and David Israels, whose work appears regularly in the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Thank you very much, David. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next guests on The Gay Life this morning are Chuck Hitchcock and David Wilt of the East End Gay Organization, from the East End of Long Island in New York. Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, David.
Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Randy.
I think the first thing I should say is how I happen to know these two gentlemen. It's been around 10 years. They've come to town for the meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, where Chuck is delivering a paper having to do with the fears of homosexuality as a problem within the psychiatric profession itself, and that'll be presented on The Gay Life in a couple of weeks when we do an entire panel on that subject based on the APA meetings. However, around 10 years ago, Chuck and I were on the faculty of a college, Southampton College, and we were office mates. At the time, I think I should say for the benefit of our listeners that I was myself deeply in the closet, and Chuck and David were the first couple about whom I made a defense against an anti-gay remark that had been made against them by a student in a context where they weren't there. And it was the first time that I made that defense with conviction rather than out of some liberal sense of obligation and asked, well, what difference does that make? And it was only a short time thereafter, around 6 months later, when I realized that it did make a difference, and it was a very positive difference to me. And although I was still in the closet, even from myself, I had already unconsciously selected these two gentlemen who are here with us this morning as role models. And it's now 10 years later. You've been together around 10 years now.
Yes, indeed.
And you've recently gotten involved in gay politics out there. What is EGO, which is East End Gay Organization? You're wearing a lovely button, which has attracted all kinds of attention, with people saying, no, what does that mean?
It was about 3 years ago that a woman lawyer, a lesbian in the East End, called a group of us together. Strange how it seemed at the time, but there were about five gay men from the Southampton area and five gay men from the East Hampton area, and we got together to discuss a couple of problems that had emerged at the same time, Randy. One of them was the Anita Bryant Dade County concern, and a number of us in the East Hampton area didn't want to see that happen on the end of Long Island. We felt that we lived in a very special place and that we wanted to do something to ensure that that place stayed as it were, which meant that it was open to people who were gay, and it was a place where people who were gay felt comfortable not only with gay neighbors and friends, but straight neighbors and friends. The other concern had to do with a beach area in Southampton that was losing its parking facilities, a gay beach area, and the men from the Southampton area were concerned about that. Out of those two issues, our lesbian friend brought together the 10 of us. We organized a meeting of about 75 people, and at that meeting were Bruce Voller and Gene O'Leary from the National Gay Task Force, and that really began the organizational aspects of EGO.
How many members do you have now?
At this point, we have a membership of about 350, equally divided between men and women, and we sort of keep that going the last 2 years now as the membership has grown. Interestingly enough, it has grown on a 50-50 basis.
That's a pretty large organization. How does that compare with other ones on the East Coast?
We have been told, and I think the facts are indeed true, that we are the largest membership organization in the state of New York. And therefore, I'm projecting that onto probably the rest of New York, of the East End or the East Coast anyway.
One of the interesting aspects of this is that half of the membership is located on the East End year-round, a little more than half, about 60%. This is a rural area during the winter, and the population probably for the five eastern townships is no more than about 30,000. During the summer, it explodes, and for the five eastern townships, we're probably talking about a population of about 300,000.
We're talking about the eastern tip of Long Island, which is about 90 to 120 miles east from New York City, but still within the state of New York.
That's right, and about 40% of the membership then lives in New York City, comes out for weekends during the winter, and will summer during a portion of the summer. It makes for an interesting mix between people who live on the East End and call it home, have a sense of it as being their home, and New York City residents who come out and see it as a place to get away from home. It means that the membership has a variety of needs and a variety of ways of hoping those needs will be met.
Well, in addition to this difference between the permanent population and the summer visitors or vacation people, there must also be a great difference in, say, income or social class between, because there are both very rich communities out there and very poor communities, and then if you add in the people who are vacationing and so forth, how is that kind of social diversity dealt with inside the group? Does it cause any tensions? Does it give the group any strengths?
I think so, but I should probably say first that we really don't experience the tremendous diversity in terms of socioeconomic background. We do in terms of age. We run from about 18 to about 65. It seems to me that most of our members come from a fairly affluent background. Those that live on the eastern end, by and large, have either retired out there or work out there in terms of being self-employed. We have some diversity, and that diversity certainly brings out the flavor of our organization in terms of political action and political concerns.
David, do you want to add something to that?
No, I guess one of the things that I find so very interesting about the organization is that great range of people that we do have in it. As Chuck has said, from the young to the old, and we work well together. We seem to have a caring for each other that has been very good and has been very good for the community out there.
You also mentioned the fact that it's remained pretty evenly co-sexual right from the beginning, and I think that's an area where rural and ex-urban organizations have managed to do a lot better than urban gay organizations, perhaps out of necessity or perhaps out of, well, just a stronger feeling of insideness and community within it.
Well, we've not really understood quite why it's worked that way. It was something that we had hoped would happen. Indeed, there was no actual striving to maintain that 50-50 situation, but it has developed and has stayed that way. We have one membership gathering a year for men and one for women, and then most of them are just open as general membership gatherings. And they're usually cocktail parties of one sort or another.
About 3 weeks ago, we hosted our first cocktail party in New York City to introduce EGO to prospective New York City residents who summered in the Hamptons. One of the things that emerged out of that, we had about 160 people, about 60% were women, 40% were men, was that for many of the men and women at the cocktail party, this was one of the first times that they were able to come together and have some substantial discussions amongst themselves, that most of the experiences that they had had in New York City were of a separatist nature. And people seemed to really enjoy the opportunity to speak to each other across sexual lines. And I think it was something that EGO facilitates very well.
The other thing that I think we should mention as we're going along is the other very special quality of EGO, the full name of the organization being the East End Gay Organization for Human Rights. And not only are we banded together for our own betterment, but we do a great deal of fundraising for other human rights organizations. In the last 2 years, we've probably raised and given away $10,000 to various organizations that are in need of it. We have a Head Start program on the East End, and we've had fundraisers for them. We've had them for the Retarded Children's Association. We've had them for a Baptist church at one of our local communities that was building a new church. And what we try to do is to get out into the community and get the community to participate in the fundraising that goes along and to become part of the project.
The establishment of East End politics is fairly conservative. If one were to look at town committees and so forth and newspapers, how have the newspapers been treating you out there, for instance? I mean, with that kind of community work, it would seem to me that it would be difficult for them to ignore the group, difficult for them to be awfully negative about it, even if they wanted to grumble a little. And although I know the attitude out there has always kind of been, well, people who are individual and discreet and private and all that, but there, it seems to me there might be a resistance to the community organizing as a community per se. That might be threatening. And yet how would they be able to criticize you if you're doing that kind of community work? What's the general reaction been in the straight community?
Well, I think one of the things that we've attempted to do is to reach out in a kind of educational manner to the local community. And by and large, the local press has been supportive of us. We've had problems here and there, but I would think most of the time they have certainly listened to us and reported in their local media our events and have commented upon them favorably. One of the things that we've attempted to do through EGO is set up an auxiliary organization called Friends of EGO, which is an organization of straight people who are in support of our attempts to gain civil rights for gay people and also in terms of our involvement with other local groups in the community who are striving for their civil rights. And that committee of straight people have been very influential with the local media as well, so that we seem to have covered a good many of those bases.
It seems to me that there's a whole new movement of gay people back to the country, or else maybe it's a movement of gay people who are in the country realizing that they don't have to be individuals in the country, that there can be communities and organizations out there. And there, for instance, there are a growing number, for instance, in this state, of organizations in the outlying counties, of newspapers in the outlying counties. And in what's a reversal of the usual situation is in rural areas now, it seems we're frequently finding organizations and community groups getting established, drawing people to an area, and then commercial establishments come in instead of the other way around, which has been historically the pattern.
I think one of the things that we have noted is that many of our commercial establishments owned and run by gays in the area predated EGO. And I suppose one of the areas we've had trouble recruiting new members have been out of the business community. And many of them have said to us that they don't see a need for a gay rights organization on the eastern end of Long Island. Others have said that the status quo they appreciate and they don't want us to rock the boat. So that the one group of people we've had difficulty getting to have been gay people in business establishments. I would be interested in an area where the commercial part came after the organization. I think it would probably enrich the life of the community.
You mentioned earlier the question of meeting the various needs. What kind of programs does EGO have for its own members? I know the other night we were talking a little bit about consciousness-raising groups. How are those organized?
We have two consciousness-raising groups going at the moment, both of them with men and women involved. And I guess we break the organization into four areas. We have our social services. Under the social services come the CR groups, as well as Friday night discussion groups held at Southampton College. We have a social component, which plans a lot of the fundraisers, the cocktail parties, yard sales, various things that we do. We also have a political component that is intended to monitor all of the board meetings, village board meetings, town meetings, and so on that go on, to interview candidates in local elections. And then we also have, what's our fourth?
The membership committee.
Membership committee, which is handling as far as the recruiting goes and trying to encourage new membership.
And one of the important things that has emerged out of this has been the role of conscious raising. We have observed that we have a board of 9 people, and it's written into the Constitution now that 5 will be of one sex and 4 of the other, so that there will be equal balance at that point. The conscious raising groups, by and large, have been the place from which the leadership has come. And so one of the important parts of the CR's endeavors has been to help us work through problems that have then given us the opportunity to go to the membership as a whole and work through problems there, so that on one level we've already gotten through what may be anger, misconceptions, stereotypes, and that I think frees us then to work with the membership as a whole, and has been very important for us.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to David Wilt and Chuck Hitchcock of the East End Gay Organization of Long Island in New York, which is a good example of the kind of developing gay consciousness on a collective level in non-urban and suburban areas. What kind of particular problems are there, though, in terms of being in what's a famous resort community and so forth? You mentioned earlier, Chuck, the summer, that there's this large influx of summer people. That's also a time when a lot of gay organizations, a lot of voluntary organizations of any kind of go into quiescence, because summertime people tend to be wanting to take care of their own needs. Do you do more in the summer, special things in the summer, less in the summer?
It depends upon, again, the express needs of the membership. The first year we started, one of the things that came to the attention of the membership as a whole was that some lesbians came back to one of our general meetings and said that one of our 2 gay bars out there was discriminating against women. During the winter, this particular bar had encouraged women, both lesbians and straight women, to come because it's so quiet there that they needed everybody during the winter. But when summer began, what we discovered later was that the owner of the bar had this fantasy that he wanted to run a gay men's bar, and suddenly he was charging women twice as much to get in. They had a policy of ignoring them at the bar and just simply harassing them in not too subtle a way. As the board, we met with the owners, didn't get very far, I have to admit, threatened. And the next thing we knew, 4 of the women from the organization staged a sit-in on the 4th of July weekend. That ended, at least for that summer, any overt kind of discrimination against women. But it has continued on a more subtle basis since then. So that at least focused a portion of our summer on a specific gay problem of the area. We find that we try and mobilize as many people as possible into social events during the summer, where during the winter there probably are more study groups, CR kinds of experiences, where more informal yet intense kinds of conversations go on.
This summer finds us doing things like sponsoring tennis tournaments. We have a couple of yard sales. We also have a major fundraising event through the summer. Last summer's was having Mitch Costanza come out, and we had a special program presentation and drew a crowd of about 500 straight and gay members for that. And so there really are lots of extra activities that we sort of put on for the summertime for the members.
Another thing is New York State has not yet legalized acts between consenting adults in private, has it? There hasn't been sodomy and oral copulation decriminalization yet.
That's correct.
Do you have a legislative program around that? And does the lack of decriminalization lead to more harassment of gay establishments and gay people than we have out here?
I think one of the areas where we recognize a need to grow is in a political arena outside of the East End of Long Island.
You did go to Washington.
About 60 of us went to Washington for the March on Washington, and the organizations sponsored one person who went to the organizing meetings at Oberlin recently. We have not been able to work our way into any kind of political work in New York State. In fact, the gay politics in New York State as a whole are fragmented and not very well focused. And a number of us feel that it's time now for us to become more involved on the state level. And certainly the statutes that you spoke of are ones that need to be addressed. I would think that one of the things that we end up doing is providing legal service or connections for legal services for a number of gay men who are arrested in rest stops in the areas, and that this is the major legal problem that the community has.
Do you have any particular problem with young gay people? It seems to me that laws being set up such that some people are afraid even to talk to someone under 18, and yet there are many young lesbians and gay men who say at 15 or 16 are fully aware of who they are and want the advice and counsel of someone who's older than them. What happens if someone who's young wants to come to an ego meeting? Do you have problems with that legally? What happens if someone calls up on your hotline and asks for counseling help or something? How can you handle something like that? This is a nationwide problem, and the reason I'm asking is because if we all share some information about this, but reaching young people who need and who are seeking assistance is a hard boundary to draw between what the state will then say is, you are recruiting.
We indeed really didn't want to handle this originally and then discovered that we were going to handle it. David and I have our telephone as the hotline so that we receive the phone calls. And what we have worked out is that if someone under 18 calls and wants information, we refer them at this point to the Alternatives Counseling Center, which is a community counseling program for the East End. Many of the therapists for the Alternatives Community Counseling Service are a part of Friends of Ego, and so that we have worked through this as a backup. And it's probably makeshift. It's probably not adequate, but it's the best we can do at this point.
Interestingly enough, we really have not gotten a tremendous amount of inquiries from young people. We do run an ad in the four local newspapers out there, and that's a continually running ad, and we do a lot of other notices and so on around, and we very seldom will get a phone call from youngsters. The college has found our membership from the college is very, very limited. And for some reason, whether they're not dealing with the homosexual feelings or whether they just at this point are still feeling too afraid to come out to any kind of a group, it's been interesting seeing, and we do indeed hope that we'll be able to encourage more of them to at least seek some participation.
There's one other aspect that should be mentioned probably, and that is if you were young and gay and lived in an urban center, it might be easier to come out. You might certainly recognize it earlier, and there would be a kind of anonymity that you could establish.
Or you at least know of a neighborhood where you can go and try out the identity for 3 hours without
exactly.
having to assume it on a permanent level.
Where if you live in a rural area, we discover that many people simply have fears that their parents or their peers are going to find out, and so that there's no easy way for them to emerge unless they decide to take a train trip of 90 to 120 miles, go into New York, and try it out there. And so it's much easier to try it out in that urban center than it is in a local rural area.
Before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to add, something I should have asked about EGO, the East End Gay Organization?
I guess one thing we might want to do is to just leave our telephone number and an address and so on. If anybody's interested in more information, certainly drop us a note. We'll send them a brochure. That would be East End Gay Organization, Box 87, Southampton, New York, 11967. And a telephone number, if you're interested in a hurry, 516-324-2468.
Okay. Why don't you repeat both of those for people who are just grabbing pencil and paper? This might be convenient for people who have closeted friends or uncloseted friends who might not know about the organization, who live in that section of the country, or those of you who have friends in New York who vacation out in the East End and might want an alternative this summer of ways of meeting other gay men and lesbians. The numbers, again.
EGO, EEGO, Box 87. Southampton, New York, 11967.
And the phone number?
Area code 516-324-2468. 2468.
Okay, thank you very much. As representatives of EGO, David Wilt and Chuck Hitchcock, thanks for being our guests on The Gay Life this morning.
Thank you, Randy.
That about wraps it up on The Gay Life this morning. Our guests have been David Israels of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, Randy Schiltz of KQED and KTVU-TV, and Chuck Hitchcock and David Wilt of Long Island's East End Gay Organization. This edition of The Gay Life has been engineered by Ern Morgan and produced by me, Randy Alfred. I also write two columns, Taking Sides and On Live, for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. The Gay Life wants to know if you're listening out there. So if you've got any suggestions about what you'd like to hear more of or what you'd like to hear less of, write to us, The Gay Life, KSAN, 345 Sansom Street, San Francisco, 94104. If you're listening on Saturday morning, this show will be repeated late Sunday night at 1 a.m. So please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN, San Francisco.